So I live in Maine. I've kind of always been from somewhere else. My father lived here in town on West Chestnut Hill Road, and my mother lived in Ohio. So when I was in Ohio, I was from Delaware, and when I was in Delaware, I was from Ohio. And that's probably a good foundation for the amount of time I spend on the road now. I like to make the analogy that I'm in kind of like a terrible band where I have no fans except for a few former teachers and some family. So, which is fine by me, but it's a lot of time on the road, and I was hoping to share a couple of things today that were more about kind of personal growth and project work. And if we have time, we can dive into some of the assignment work that I do. But after journalism school, I went and worked at a newspaper in Florida for a few years as a general assignment photographer, which is between 2 and 5 assignments a day, where the spectrum of what you see can be pretty pronounced. I mean, you can have. I always talk about you could photograph a funeral in the morning and the mayor at noon and a hamster race at the local pet store in the evening, and you really have to be able to switch gears pretty quickly and turn around, synthesize what you're doing, synthesize a story, and turn it around fairly quickly on deadline, on demand. And after a few years of doing that, I was a little bit not worn out, but I was looking forward to trying to work with a bit more intention and trying not to be so I tried not to be as reactive with my work. So I decided to go freelance and was talking to my father, who had recently retired from the university here, and we talked about possibly. We daydreamed about maybe moving out west together. And I moved to Colorado with sort of abstract hopes of that coming true, and then my father fell ill and passed away. And so as a general assignment photographer, I was both grieving and also kind of trying to find my own voice, and became obsessed with finding out a little bit more information about my father. And so I hit the road for a few months and traveled throughout the American West in some of the landscapes that were particularly important to him during his life. And he was a great storyteller, so I had this trove of stories that I could rely on, but kind of no specifics. And I had a very patient wife who went with me and tolerated me, pacing around and being self-absorbed. What I did find as I traveled around the country wasn't so much him in the landscape, but more of myself. And I became really, I found my focus. When I first got into this, I thought I was going to go cover war and conflict when I first became a photographer. And I realized that what I truly enjoy are wild places and being by myself, I think. And looking for ways to have larger conversations about land use and land ethics and culture and the intersection between culture, economy, and the landscape with the work. These photos never went anywhere, by the way, too. This is all just personal work. And it was a step back professionally to take time off, but it was also much needed, not just for the grieving process, but also because I was a little bit disillusioned with daily news coverage. The Colorado theater shooting in Aurora happened when I was out there, and I was looking at I almost got published by Time magazine for it, right? And I had never been published by anybody of that caliber. And I remember working long hours, day after day after day, with a pack of other photographers, and really not being Well, being mildly ashamed, I'd say, actually, of the reality of having to cover something like that, where you have to set aside your own how you behave around people to satisfy deadlines, and the application of like the free market system and a struggling freelancer in the context of such tragedy, I found to be really not just exhausting, but just a little bit of you kind of dies with that. And when I remember sending the director of photography at time what I'd been doing, and then there was this kind of abstract promise that this was going to go in the magazine, and I was really happy about that. And then it didn't, and then I was really upset about that. And then I took a deep breath, and I thought, oh my gosh, like, I don't know how you get to that point where you don't, where you want to succeed on something like that, or on the back of something like that. And so the combination of those two things made me realize that I needed to focus, and I needed to have something that meant more than just my next deadline. I don't see a difference between my photography and myself, and so the difference, trying to figure out and trying to analyze the person that I am rather than the person like I think I should be, if that makes sense. And I don't want to turn this into like a navel gazing, like I'm so sad, like I'm not, I'm good. But I did, there in 2013, I did find the connection I was looking for, which was in a lot of ways has a lot to do with my dad too. Even though I was looking for him in that landscape, I realized that a lot of his worldview, I was really proud to adopt that legacy and continue that legacy. And I just needed to distill that a bit more. So I found, through an assignment with Wall Street Journal, I discovered the Ogallala Aquifer. So the Ogallala Aquifer is an enormous underground body of water that stretches from southern South Dakota to the Texas Panhandle, and included in that is Nebraska, obviously South Dakota, Kansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Texas, Wyoming, Colorado. And people have called it an underground ocean. I think that's a little bit misleading. It's an aquifer is just wet dirt, essentially. But it's responsible for, what is it, 1/5 of all agricultural production in the United States. Cotton, wheat, corn, beef, sunflowers, and a number of other things. And when I was, I just couldn't believe the economic implications something like that would have. And I was fascinated with this idea of the thread of natural history being responsible, you know, the idea of connecting natural history to civilization. I was also a little bit ashamed of myself when I realized how enormous it was, and how I had no understanding of it, even though I had been working atop of it for quite some time. And so I set about, in my spare time, in between assignments, in between moving, in between various editorial commissions, trying to create a body of work that would explore these intersections between people and the landscape. You know, how does a layer of wet dirt that's 1,800 feet below the surface, how is that responsible for the kid working at Taco Bell? You know, like how do you bridge those connections? And that's what I set out to do. So I'm going to show you the first part of the first chapter of this, which is almost primarily landscapes and aerials. This is a work in progress. If you don't like it, keep it to yourself. Or, but no, please feel free to ask any questions. As I roll through this too, if there's time, I'm happy to show you some of the assignment work I do as well. But so in this vast American desert that was called in the early 1900s land that was wholly unfit for cultivation. But if you look back at 1540, Coronado takes his army and marches north out of Mexico and wanders onto the high plains. And they're searching for the city of gold. And so it's this vast, featureless, dry expanse with extremely disorienting. The guide purposely leads them around, leads him the wrong way to try to spare some of the tribes from his wrath, but he eventually ends up in Kansas and is introduced to the tribe, the Kavira tribe, which the city of gold that he was looking for was also called Kavira, but obviously there was no gold in western Kansas in 1542. And so he slaughters his guide and marches his men back to Mexico. What he didn't realize what was underneath his feet. It wasn't until the late, I think 1898, when a geologist outside of Oglala, Nebraska, is working outside of town and notices in some of the striations that are exposed, he notices this pink sediment layer. A few years later, he's down in Texas working in the panhandle. He notices the same pink sediment layer and then goes on to realize that it's all connected. So part of what I'm trying to do is explore this idea of land management, which is about the most unsexy thing you can ever tell an editor. Like when you're talking about your project, like, what's your project about? And I'm like, land management. And they're like, oh, is it about climate change? I'm like, no. It's land management, and they're like, oh God, no, we're not going to do this. But like, I am interested in this idea of the myth of the Western landscape in terms of it being wild and untamed. It is vast, but it is highly managed. And I'm not sure if Mark Twain said it. I tried to Wikipedia it before I did this, but the whole... The quote of around here, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, holds true. So in this vast expanse of land that is highly managed and very fluid, you have Nebraska holding the majority of the aquifer, and the water table there is fairly healthy. The further south you go, you are looking at a diminishing water table because of agricultural production, and the more efficient we get with farming, such as the center pivot irrigation system, which really kind of expanded like heavily and changed the entire entire Western landscape in the 1970s. The more efficient you have your instruments are, the more you can actually do. It's like when the iPhone came out, and they're like, look at all you can do. You know, it's going to be so much faster. Well, you just have to do that much more. And so the it scaled up production, and now you're talking about areas in Texas and New Mexico and Kansas and Oklahoma that are running dry. I always say, you know, to talk about saving the aquifer is not about necessarily saving a layer of wet dirt. It's to talk about saving ourselves. And looking at that landscape and looking how people have changed it over the last few hundred years is something to behold. You know, something even as simple as shifting from bison to cattle. Bison will move in a herd and tend not to follow like in single file. So in a place like here, Plainview, Texas, you see the impact of cattle following each other in lines. They tend to go in single file. And that can have generational implications for the landscape. It's just just strictly in terms of evidence. I'm not anti-cattle in Plainview, Texas, but just in terms of evidence of like how people impact that landscape. An interesting fact about Plainview as well is the Ogallala was responsible for almost for most of the settlement on the High Plains, and that was brought about because of railroads. Railroads needed rail stations in order to refuel their steam engines. And so there was a concerted effort to propagandize how great life was out on the high plains. So in Plainview, Texas, for instance, they tapped the aquifer and filled up a lake in town, and then advertised it to folks back east as this paradise on the plains and sailboats. And people went out in droves. Well, the pumps broke about 4 years later. The lake dried up, which is so, and it hasn't been there since. This is a similar situation in the Sand Hills in Nebraska, which is a different climate. The Sand Hills is the primary recharge point for the Ogallala. This is the area that, like, if the Keystone Pipeline would go through and, say, break, it would contaminate the aquifer. And the economic implications of something like that are profound. Again, just I'm trying to find the textures and the patterns of that are, in a way, evidentiary to what we depend on to sustain ourselves. And that can range from agriculture to oil and gas. Outside of Midway, Odessa, Texas, it was traditionally, there's a lot of oil exploration. Well, now they're transitioning to fracking. So there's an enormous infrastructure and holding area ready to mobilize to go out into the landscape to further feed the machine, as well as suburban sprawl. Just to talk a little bit about process, I opted to photograph this using film, using a pretty ancient Hasselblad camera, because I'm Polish and I like to do things the hard way, especially when it comes to aerials. So if you hang out the side of a plane with a Hasselblad, it's about the most inefficient way to ever work. But for those of you who knew my father, I think he could appreciate that. I chose to photograph this project in black and white too because of the topographical variation in the landscape, and I was worried that between the seasons and the landscape itself, that if I didn't unify it through process, that it could get a little bit confusing, and people wouldn't realize that it was all connected. Looking at feedlots and big business, this is what a friend editor of mine calls Calschwitz, which is it's a terrible joke, but it's also it's amazing the scale of the agriculture and out there, and like what that's an entire another conversation when you talk about like the myth of farming or the myth of like. Well, it's not a myth of farming. I live in Maine, where actually it's exactly like it looks. It's almost storybook. but when you look at the big farms out west, and you know, and the schools all have like their Monsanto wings of the Monsanto Gymnasium or the Monsanto Award for 4-H, or I guess seeing the connective threads of influence and motivations between institutions such as our public schools and big business is something that I'm
Can you just go back?
Sure.
So I'm guessing that all those little dots are each one is a cow.
Yes.
So that's a gigantic feedlot, and as I understand it, there are 13 states in the U.S. where taking that picture is illegal.
Yes.
So what did you just take it and not tell anybody, or is this not a state where that's from, or what?
I told the pilot. that's a good point. They call those ag gag laws, and Kansas is notorious for that. And there's a National Geographic photographer who just got into a bunch of trouble. He launched a glider and was taking photos of farm, I guess, of feedlots, and was arrested for it. A lot of those laws are really meant to limit people's access to the practices and the view of that. And they say it's bad for business, but I think there was a few years back where a drone operator actually in Texas photographed blood from a feedlot spilling into a waterway, and they were most concerned with the fact that the drone operator took the photo as opposed to the blood spilling in. Yeah.
But what's the given rationale for outlawing photos like that?
It's bad for business.
They say that?
They say that people cannot handle the truth of where their food comes from, and that it infringes on their capacity to make a living and their rights to work as they please. Now, in Texas, I'm actually able to take that photo. In Kansas, I am not. So between the laws in terms of my access, but also in terms of even water usage, Texas water rights are different from Kansas's water rights, which are different from Oklahoma's, different from New Mexico's, different from Wyoming's, and different from Nebraska's and South Dakota's. But the aquifer does not pay attention to state boundaries. And so where a place like Texas, which values private property rights perhaps more profoundly than other places, if it's under your feet, it is yours, which goes back to English common law, which is up to heaven and down to hell. You own the rights. That same theme is actually, I'm applying that to a body of work I'm working on fracking now, which is a segue I don't need to go into, but it's go ahead.
I've written about this issue a lot. I've never understood the intent of the law. So is it illegal for you to take it, or is it illegal for you to publish it?
It depends on the state. It's not illegal for me to take that picture in Texas or publish it. I also don't think that they would be able to figure out which one it was. So no, they wouldn't know if there was an opportunity to go after me. It'd be hard to figure out exactly where it was to do that. But I don't have the I would never do that in Kansas because I could not afford the legal ramifications of that. Nebraska, you can do whatever you want. So it really does vary. And a great resource for familiarizing yourself with the laws, if you don't want to dive into the legalese, is to talk to the pilots. And the best way to access pilots at an affordable rate are flight schools. For anyone who's interested in ever doing that. One of the best pilots I had was in Wyoming, who used to be an Air Force guy, but he was attached to NASA, and so he worked in mission control, and I've never felt so safe. A lot of my other work is way more intimate in terms of portraiture, in terms of talking with folks and trying to convey a sense of personality. And with this, I'm really trying to step back and take a look at evidence and structures, and see if I can find a narrative in that, which is challenging for someone like me because I feel like I'm fairly personable and I don't have a problem typically gaining access. But one of the hesitations I had with making individuals prominent characters in this project was that it seemed to be a bit of a false intimacy. It's such a vast, expansive area and territory that to put a face on it, it didn't seem like an appropriate thing. So an appropriate way to work. So I purposely have been avoiding photographing individuals close in a way that could say that could tether that person's identity, I guess, per se. I think that one of the realities of being a newspaper or a magazine photographer is that I will often get tasked with going into a town, say in Maine, where the mill has closed down, and you've got a deadline of the next day or that night to try in the best way you can summarize a community, which is really, really challenging. So it becomes more of a circumstantial project where if you'll go to the town in Maine and the paper mill closed, and whoever crosses my line of sight is the person that I need to say, excuse me, I'm a photographer working for the New York Times, and I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the mill and what that means, and then they will become the face of this thing. And that's just the reality of deadline work. I don't know how to get around that, but since I do have time to work on this and to plug away at this, I'm much more interested in the stuff that I don't get to do in the context of my assignment work. Another thing I'm really interested with this is the idea of not just water usage, because I don't know if you noticed, but there hasn't been a single picture of water yet because it's underground. But I'm also interested in this idea of sort of the passive complicity of environmental impact. So if you're plugged into the grid, and I'm the first one to, I mean, I drive a lot for my work. I burn a ton of fossil. My carbon footprint is probably equivalent to, you know, half the people in this room put together. And that really, I want to engage with people about that. Not just myself, but in terms of if you're plugged in, you know, if you're keeping the lights on the cross all night, or if you're, it's basically almost all of our activities, like we're sort of all part of the problem, right? And the, whether you're talking about fresh water, or whether you're talking about fossil fuel consumption, or whether you're talking about fossil fuel consumption that comes from this place where fresh water is precious, which is sort of the, you've got both things going on the Ogallala. These kinds of things I find fascinating. You know, another myth about agriculture too, or not a myth, but one of the things I did not understand was just how high tech it is. I don't know how many of you guys have been in a modern combine, but it is incredible. It's like the space shuttle. Satellite guided that stores data from, say, like the last 20, 30, 40, 50 plantings, if they're doing two plantings a year. And the satellite will actually guide the tractor, say, an inch to the left and rotate it 5 degrees so you're not planting in the same hole. And so the driver of the combine, the farmer, will turn the tractor around and then hit auto, and the tractor does everything for you via the satellite. It'll also fertilize. It'll keep records oftentimes of crop yields, and it can adjust fertilization intensities according to which parts of the field were more productive or less productive in a way to try to even it out, which I just find fascinating. It's the growing disconnect between our food and the things that we need to maintain our civilization. The growing disconnect is something that I find really interesting as well. This body of work is also up at Westchester University right now. I installed it last week, and if there is something that you guys want to look at a little bit more, you're welcome to go to the Naur Gallery and check it out. A huge transition to wind energy too in West Texas. It's like a lot of things. I mean, even like oil and natural gas, is there's not it doesn't employ a ton of people, but it is interesting to watch that landscape change. And in talking with folks out there, there seems to be not the same kind of. It's almost like people are nostalgic for oil and gas. It's interesting and don't necessarily in casual conversations don't necessarily view the wind farms with the same level of appreciation. So it's kind of an interesting like cultural dynamic going on with that. How this all formed was basically the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains, where eons of erosion pulled debris, sediment, boulders, rocks, and spread them across the plains. So looking at, for the first time, and I have no level of expertise in any of this, like I'm terrified there's like a geologist in the crowd that is going to, but looking at how something so massive and happened so long ago is such a determining factor in what we enjoy today. Like even the food here, like right now, is there beef in any of that? I mean, it's kind of because of this. or there's like a high statistical chance that there is, or even like Cold War era missile silos. The idea that you could have something as precious as groundwater that was so vital to the national economy and national security, to have something like nuclear warheads posed over top of it. These are shuttered. They wouldn't let me fly over that if it wasn't. But